Hello and welcome to Circling the Cup, San Jose Sharks podcast, episode number 63, also known as the end of the season, the beginning of the playoff podcast, because our week hugs both of those things. And in some ways good, in other ways not so good. I'm Alex, here with me this week, awake early because he had to wake up and watch tonight's playoff game. Colin, what's up, Colin?
No.
Great.
No.
Once again, the week started with happiness, just so you, just in case you guys weren't watching the game this week. And of course, Ben, as always, is here. What's up, Ben?
Hi.
Oh, there you go. But here's the thing. See,
I'm going to be the voice of reason tonight. Well, yeah.
Can I tell you, though, Ben, your enthusiastic high is like Martin Jones's serial killer eyes. It's just something off, something a little off. So the playoffs have started. You know what, guys? I say we just jump straight into this. Let's just get the game that no one cares about out of the way, which was the season finale against Calgary, the San Jose Sharks. Guess what, guys?
Wait, hold on. I think you mean the San Jose Barracuda.
Yeah.
Well, yes, true. I was going to get there. The Sharks / Barracuda won this game 3-1. Ben, of course, you mean the fact that the Sharks decided to rest a couple of players. And, of course, the Barracuda came up. And by the way, Barracuda looked pretty good.
Yeah, maybe the Sharks should have thought of resting some guys tonight.
Yeah, true. Well, I will tell you this: the AHL Rookie of the Year, Dana Regan, scored the final goal of the season for the San Jose Sharks. So there you go. There's something to hang your hat on. Goals from Chris Tierney, Bodker, and Regan. And again, this was it. Look, I know it's the last game of the season, and I know that both these teams were more or less locked into their playoff situations, but you know, the Junior Sharks looked pretty good, I thought.
Yeah. I mean, they were as fast.
They were playing an actual Calgary team.
I mean, they were as fast as we've seen them.
Dell looked great.
As he often did this year. Good old Dell.
We didn't play him more often.
Bodker's goal was pretty.
That's true.
There was a lot to like about that game. I mean, it's not like the Sharks really blew Calgary off the ice, but you know, it's two teams sort of playing hard going into the playoffs. And I don't think there was anything we could really take away from that game going into the playoffs. I don't feel like having watched the Calgary game.
No,
you know, I knew what was coming, but
you know what, that narrative too. There was a little inkling of that from around the internet of, hey, well, hey, good news, guys, the Sharks won that game, and so they got some momentum going. And no, that's not their starters. No, not at all. Don't get me wrong; it's great to end the season to win it. And again, awesome performance by the youngins. But you couldn't really read anything into that. In fact, this was about as close to an exhibition game as you could have gotten.
Because Barkley Goodrow wasn't going to stay up, and Danny Regan unfortunately wasn't going to stay up. So, you know, it was nice to end the season on an up note, given how poorly the Sharks played good teams over March. Not to say that that was foreshadowing tonight's game or anything, but certainly it was a nice change of pace.
Yeah, and by the way, because there really isn't much to talk about that game, that change of pace, oh, look, now I'm that guy, carried over to the Sharks' first playoff game against the Oilers. We're going to talk we're going to talk a lot about this game. I want to talk about the Sharks win this game. Look, they come back. Oilers score two goals, one of which was on a pretty okay-ish counterattack. The other one was a power play goal. And the Sharks ended up fighting back, and we'll go into depth as to how that happened. But this series started off with one of the cooler things that I've ever seen, which was the way that the Edmonton Oilers are handling, apparently, this entire playoffs. It appears, the national anthem, which I know seems like a small thing, but for most of us, the national anthem is just kind of like a thing that's there, gets in the way of, you know, you getting your beer and the game starting. But they had their singer in the stands singing along. He basically only sang two lines, which, by the way, this is a great strategy because I can't sing all that well, but I'm pretty sure I can sing the first line of the national anthem. And if I just turn the mic over to the rest of the crowd, no one will notice and I'll be like a professional singer. But honestly, that was really cool. And what it reminded me of is, you know, having traveled a lot to Europe and having a lot of friends who are from Europe who have moved here, one of the things that I really miss about that culture is sort of, you know, when you go to a bar, you go to a pub, and everyone just starts, you know, they get obliterated, just start singing together. There's this camaraderie that you just, you know, it's pretty tough to get elsewhere. And that's exactly what they got out of their fans with that performance of National Anthem. Now, of course, they haven't been in the playoffs for forever, so there was some of that too. But
yeah,
I got to say, that was really cool and really well done.
I think we just go ahead, Colin, and then I've got a thought.
Well, it's funny that you say camaraderie and such and mention Europe when it comes to the anthem, since the most common opinion I've had over here is that seeing the anthem before sporting events is a frightening display of militant nationalism.
Yeah. I didn't mean the singing of the anthem specifically in Europe. I just meant, you know, when you go out, like a great example is if you go to England, if you go to like outside of London, and it's like the same pub crew that's always there, and they're chanting really old World War II songs that make no sense because they weren't in World War II, that the generation singing it, and, you know, their parents were obviously, or they're singing some soccer songs, which are pretty awesome.
So I guess what I wanted to do is, I know you've jumped right to the game, but I feel like we should probably, since we didn't have a true playoff preview, talk about the uncertainty we had even going into the game.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
You know, I mean, we entered the week, you know, with the youth crew playing that final game against Calgary. We didn't really know who was going to be healthy and who wasn't going to be healthy for these games, which made it really hard to evaluate what to expect of the Sharks going into game one, right? So to kind of summarize really quickly my feeling of this week, I think if you talk to you or you, Alex, or you, Colin, or me going into game one, we would have been happy coming home 1-1, more or less.
Oh, and I'm still happy coming home 1-1.
And that's because, you know, we weren't sure Couture was going to be back at all.
Or to what capacity, if he was.
And what percentage he'd be playing at if he did come back. And now we know it's good but not peak Couture, to coin a phrase. We didn't know what was going to be up with Jumbo, right? We didn't know if he was going to be playing or not. And he claimed, you know, a week and a half ago that he would be there for game one. And that clearly was a prediction that didn't come true. So with those two things in mind, I feel like I should be happier tonight.
Yeah, for those of you who are wondering, we're talking immediately following game two, which is not as magical as game one, which we'll get to.
So that's where we were kind of as we entered game one is, oh, geez, Couture's going to play. That's awesome. Oh, my God, Haley's on the bench. I'm so happy.
Yeah.
And then the first period happened, which you've already alluded to, and we were down 2-0. I took a walk. With about 2.5 minutes left in period one, I was like, F this noise. And I did what I'd sometimes do, and I cooled off by going out and taking a walk. I came back and shot some tanks, and then I sat down for period two. I don't know how you guys felt after the first period.
I didn't feel you know, what's interesting was, you know, in watching that first period, I was very frustrated when the Sharks went down for obvious reasons, especially that first goal, because it looked like the Sharks were dominating that beginning portion. They controlled the tempo. It was a very fast tempo, especially for the Sharks. It looked really good. And then, you know, a quick kind of counterattack, and that all started to go a little bit sideways. And then, you know, they did one of their normal Sharks things where it's like they're not going to play a full period quite well. But here's where I was happy. You know, as frustrated as I was that they were down two, through the second and through the third, they had a dominant performance. And that's something that I wasn't expecting. If you had asked me before this series what I was expecting of the series, I would have told you that I believe that the Sharks roster was deeper, that overall the Sharks roster was better, that they were slumping going into the playoffs, and that was concerning, and that injuries were a large enough concern that I would look at this series and go, you know, it could go either way, but I'm probably leaning more towards the Oilers in six or seven. Watching them play the second and third game, my immediate reaction, I had two immediate reactions, one of which, Ben, you correctly predicted, which was sort of the idea that it seems like whenever McClellan's in the building, regardless of whether he's coaching the Sharks or not, they sort of play like they did under him, in that they were dominating but not putting points up for the longest time in that game, which was incredibly frustrating. But, you know, at the end of the game, that performance was possession was so dominant. Shot attempts was so dominant.
Yep.
They looked so sharp and so fast, despite, you know, the injuries that they were carrying, that I left that game making the foolish, you know, sort of thought in my head of, well, there's no way Edmonton's going to win, you know, four out of this series. Like, if the Sharks play like this, right, even with injuries, this series is wrapped up. And I'm not going to say that that's gone away necessarily, but that's how dominant that game one performance was. Well, and it was shocking.
That's how challenging for me tonight's game is. You know, if go back, you know, a week, and in considering that we could have been without our top two centers, was sort of my perspective, was the Sharks could not possibly win this series. No, what team can weather missing your top two centers going into the playoffs? There isn't one.
Especially when one of those centers is meant to take over core responsibilities from the other one when he eventually retires.
Yeah. And, you know, having one of those guys back, I felt a little bit better. And again, that first period was not great, but you're right. The Sharks play was dominant in a way that we haven't seen the Sharks be dominant in months. The only thing they weren't doing is scoring goals, and then they got the clutch goals they needed to, and it sure looked like the Sharks had flipped a playoff switch, kind of like they did last year.
For me, when we were talking going into the first playoff game, I fully expected us to lose the first game, come back the second, and, you know, not have the complete inverse happen. And it's weird for me to see how badly we sort of reacted to a win, you know, reacted to a hard work win too.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that for a second, Colin, because you and I kind of pre-game one were talking about what could be the possible outcomes. And you very much expected that sort of the same outcome we saw in the last Edmonton game in the regular season, that the Sharks would keep it tight and then give up a couple goals and it would be 4-2. And I looked at it a couple ways. I agreed with you that was a likely outcome potentially. But there were two things on my mind that made me wonder if maybe the Sharks could get sneak out of game one with a win. First of all, McClellan's a bad coach who does bad things, and he doesn't adjust. Second, you know, the Edmonton Oilers haven't played a playoff game in 11 years, and most of those guys are pretty young, and they don't really know what they're doing in the sense of how pressure-filled a game like this can be. So I was thinking, hey, it could even go as far as a Sharks laugher. Now, that's not what happened, but the Sharks did ultimately pull out that win with a really sweet, sweet, sweet goal in overtime from Melker Carlson, who has earned that spot all year long.
Yeah.
Done everything the team has asked, been one of the best players on the team, despite getting mostly fourth-line minutes, I've thought. The effort's there, the stick is there, the full offensive defensive game is there, the two-way game is there. He's been awesome in a way that a lot of players on this team have not been.
Yeah, I would say the closest player to Carlson that we have is Hansen. And when we traded for Hansen, we basically got a Carlson with more speed and a better shot.
Yeah, maybe it needs to start, you know, coming through, especially in these playoffs. You know, Ward scored a goal too. And I mean, you talk about sort of playoff consistency. I mean, that's why we got Ward, and, you know, he brought the first one in there. I want to throw a couple of stats your guys away from this game, just to kind of really highlight this performance. The Sharks outshot the Oilers 44-19, and those are obviously shots on net. If you want to talk about shot attempts, the Sharks had 87 to Edmonton's 43. And possession was entirely skewed the Sharks' way. The biggest stopping block, it seemed, for the Sharks was basically Cam Talbot. Had a great performance.
So
hold on real quick, because what I want to say is I do have one slight concern, and that is the goaltender on the other side of the ice, which is Martin Jones, who in the first game had a couple of really nice saves. But to me, his lateral movement looked a little late or a little sluggish. Ben, I'm not going to say tired, because it's not necessarily it's not that I think he's tired. Right. It's just usually he comes off as much, much quicker, much more athletic. That's something that also cropped up in tonight's game.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, if it comes down to a goaltender duel, you know, I love Martin Jones, but we need a little bit more out of him.
I don't think Jones was sharp in either game particularly, though I do think he was better in game two most of the time.
Other than the goal scored against him, yeah.
Well, I mean, that second goal he gave up, Vlasic did everything he could to force that to the outside, and Jones just didn't have the angle. So as you say, the lateral movement is an issue. I think a bigger thing than just Jones, though, because the team really did kind of clamp down and bail him out of game one with effort, with what have you, is three guys really stood out as having a better game than they've had in a while. One of those guys is Ward, as you say. I thought he had a really good game, and obviously he was there on the power play. Jonas Donskoy had a better game than I've seen him have in maybe all season, I thought, in game one, not game two, obviously.
Yeah.
Because, you know, these same guys who stepped up in game one seemed to be pretty invisible game two. Not to say that Hurdle hasn't had great games, but he was dominant in game one.
Oh, Hurdle looked phenomenal.
And he very much wasn't in game two. Almost nobody, it seemed, showed up for game two.
So, Alex, the question I have is, in game one, do you feel that the shots led to possession or the possession led to shots?
I thought the possession. I thought the Sharks did an excellent job with their transitional game. I think the Sharks did an excellent job on the forecheck and with their backcheck. In general, I would lean more towards, without, you know, going through the entire game again, I would lean towards they did everything right for the most part. I appreciated the fact that they were shooting, which is something that really frustrated me about tonight's game, especially on the power play. But I would say that I think that the possession led to the shots more than the other way around. Why? What would you say?
Well, I'm sort of disagreeing in that one thing, and I know Ben hates this sort of argument, but I think one of the things that we really gained by being more shoot first in game one is we got to get the scrambles, but also we forced a lot more faceoffs in the offensive zone, and we were winning those faceoffs a lot of the time in game one.
So let me just say that one thing that I think, you know, I don't know what the Sharks did in the second and third period to turn things around, but they were shooting in the first period as well. It's just that they were shooting it right into Edmonton's skates. So they weren't getting shots on goal.
Yeah.
And that leads to Edmonton's transition, which is exactly what happened tonight.
Yeah. One of the things I'm really impressed with regarding the Oilers is the fact that I've noticed this. They are extremely good at getting in the lanes. They're extremely good at keeping their sticks on the ice to block pucks that are kind of coming through. And, you know, what that does, for those of you who don't play hockey, I mean, it might seem obvious, but it's really easy to lift your stick off the ice when you're skating around. By keeping it on the ice, you effectively have the opportunity to block a puck and do a quick counterattack, which is exactly, you know, how they've been scoring basically this season. The other thing that I really noticed in game one that I was impressed with was how well the Sharks were suppressing Connor McDavid. Because I think when I look at this Edmonton Oilers team, I'm not saying that they are a bad team by any means, but I don't think they're as deep or have as much overall skill as the San Jose Sharks. Maybe not yet. Maybe they'll grow into it. McDavid, obviously. And if you let McDavid run away with this, you know, he can completely control a game. And the Sharks have done a really good job of not allowing that to happen. And they did a pretty good job of keeping him off the board in game one, which I felt was a pretty big difference. Now, here's something that I will say, Ben, and I know you're going to love this. I keep calling out to you because you're the anti-narrative guy. And I normally feel this way about this narrative as well. The Sharks, for the last several years, Wilson's trumpeted the idea of, you know why we haven't won a cup? We don't have enough cup winners, because it comes down to the experience. And we've argued, you know, the last couple of seasons that your cup winners actually have to have done something, you know, or be quality players for that to work. And I think in general, when you think of NHL players, look, these guys are professional athletes. You know, they always come ready to play. So the idea of, like, having more experience, having more playoff experience, to me is sort of like, I'll tell you what, maybe not for game two, but game one, that's exactly what it looked like. It looked like you were talking about a team full of 30-year-old Sharks that have been to the playoffs year after year against a ton of Edmonton youth who hadn't experienced it yet. And again, I think that speaks to sort of the dominance of that game one performance by the Sharks.
I mean, I know I put forward that idea that if the Sharks pulled game one out, it would be largely because Edmonton had issues sort of rising to the pressure of a playoff game. And that's what game one definitely looked like to some extent. But I also would say, like you say, that, you know, top to bottom, especially on the forward or defense, the Sharks are or should be a deeper, better team, whether as long as they're only missing one of their top two centers, you know, because it is kind of, it's to some extent, if you want to talk about, you know, top six players, they've got McDavid, they've got, Leon Draisaitl and Lucic to a lesser extent. And then the rest of the guys are kind of like tweeners. They're kind of second line, third line guys, Maroon, Nugent Hopkins, what have you. If you're talking about like guys who have a full, you know, two-way game that you need to have to be successful in the playoffs, and that's it. Like the rest of those guys are third and fourth line plugs at best. That includes, unfortunately, the guy who scored the game-winning goal tonight, Cashin. That guy's garbage, but he got an opportunity, and Jones didn't rise to the occasion.
So one of the things I mentioned this while we were watching the first game, and I feel I need to follow through, which is, you know, the officiating in the first game was great. Like, I saw the refs calling a really straight, clean, focused game, and it kept the play tight. And, you know, that really sort of detriments players like Cashin, because he wants a no rules, you know.
I mean, I hear you. The Sharks had six power plays tonight.
Oh, no, no, no.
It's not like the refs.
I'm not trying to lay game two on the refs by any means. You know, that game was self-inflicted gunshot wound.
I mean, I have to admit, I start to upchuck in my mouth a little bit when I hear the words well-refereed game tied to Tim Peel, but on the same token, I don't disagree with you. I thought that there was a fairly consistent, fairly well refed game one.
And with how badly and how much we've been dumping on the refs for, I don't know, the existence of the podcast.
Tonight, you know, tonight there's the weak slash. There's the, you know, Cashin left his feet like a missile at Kocher's head. So they certainly missed some stuff tonight.
No, I'm keeping entirely on game one.
He's not there yet, Ben.
During game one, I made the point when we were talking that, you know, the refs have done a great job, and they did a great job. And, you know, they did an okay job in the first part of game two. And then I guess they just realized that giving us power plays was basically just killing us. So
I'm really at this point, I'm kind of baffled. Like, I don't know how to reconcile game one with game two.
Yeah,
well, hold on.
Before we get there, I want to point out one more thing with game one, and that is that the Oilers appeared to be trying to put the physical game on very heavily, particularly after they took the lead, and that ended up causing them to chase quite a bit, which was to the Sharks' advantage. Now, just to go over the score, because we didn't really get into it. Final score was 3-2 with the Sharks in overtime. They had come back from a two-goal first period deficit on goals from Joel Ward, Mr. Playoffs, Paul Martin. Hey, another guy we brought for the playoffs, Melker Carlson. Now I think we should move into game two, because this game was the opposite. The first period started out, you know, okay for the first like 5 or 6 minutes. And really, you know, the first period ended 0-0. So it didn't really seem like, you know, it wasn't a great period. It wasn't a terrible period. But then things kind of went sideways. There was a really bad play by Joe Pavelski, which led to a quick turnaround by Cashin and a shorthanded goal. And then towards the end of the game, there was another shorthanded goal by Connor McDavid. But here's what I took away from this game, which is extremely unfortunate. And it's not like I didn't already know it, but the Sharks special teams, I mean, that was a clinic on how not to run special teams. Their power play was not only abysmal, but there were opportunities to shoot the puck where they chose that it was like the old school pass, 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 pass. And look, when you're playing the Oilers, which we saw this game, and we already mentioned for the last game, their sort of ability to get, you know, sticks in the lanes and cause a quick turnover, that's valid, but you still have to shoot the puck. I think they went like, you know, three. I think they only had two shots on net out of four power plays, if I recall correctly. Yeah,
it was something ridiculous.
Actually, I think I'm looking at the stats now. I think that on Sharks power plays, the Sharks had six shots on goal and the Edmonton Oilers had five.
Yeah.
The Sharks had like one scoring chance.
Yeah, you can't do that. And as I mentioned before, you know, even though his save percentage was better this time around, which was really more a reflection of the Oilers controlling more of the game, both goals scored on Martin Jones
not they're painfully soft.
Yeah, like not like
they were Miami soft.
He barely, you know, look, I mean, it's not easy playing a goal, being goaltender in NHL. I totally understand that. And in a lot of cases, in both those situations, he was left high and dry by the defense. But, you know, we've seen him play better in those scenarios and faster and wiser. And you can tell he can see the puck. So, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see how he continues to play the rest of the series, because I guarantee you, just as much as if Connor McDavid probably hadn't scored the second goal today, we would have started to hear the "Can Connor McDavid play in the playoffs?" narrative from, you know, the freaked out Canadian press. You know, I think you're going to start to hear Sharks fans start asking, you know, the question of why didn't the Sharks rest him more in March, and is that affecting his game or what? And I don't necessarily think it is personally, but I think when you see a goaltender like him who can make those saves, not really put a lot of movement or effort into it, then that's a natural question that comes up.
Here's how I kind of feel about that. So obviously Jones is culpable on both those goals. They're soft. He should have them. Yes. But I don't blame the loss on him.
No. Yeah. I'm not saying that at all.
This is the worst power play I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
It lacked confidence. It lacked structure. It lacked shooting, as you've mentioned. I mean,
they couldn't form is what drove me nuts all game on the power play and the penalty kill specifically. Is that, like, on the power play, look, everybody by now should know the Sharks play. They're going to cycle low, pass it back to Burns. He's going to shoot. They could not form a triangle to cycle to save their life. And on defense, when they were trying to play like what looked like a small collapsing box, they were just getting pulled. Everyone was chasing, and it really felt like, you know, they were, the second they went down, they all shifted to not playing their game and trying to do too much and chase and chase. And you can't do that. It doesn't work. But
if you were to, like, historically look at playoff teams and going out of the regular season in the playoffs, you can rank them in special teams, and typically those teams will be in the top 10 on either penalty killing or power play. The really good teams will be in the top 10 for both. Rarely do you ever see a team come out of the regular season with one of the worst power plays in the league, you know, still able to do something. We had one of the better power plays, but I still don't think we were top 10.
No, we weren't even close. I think we finished the year in the 20s. The power play was bad.
No, I mean for penalty kill.
The penalty kill, I think, was like 18th. It was below average.
Yeah.
And I mean, so if you were to use, even after the two games, if you were to just rank the teams by special teams, we have no business being in the playoffs right now. And you cannot expect to go past the first round with these sort of numbers, especially since a horrible power play is basically a license to penalties by the other team.
I think the argument we might have considered last year would have been almost the opposite, which is the Sharks, you know, were specializing on special teams. And when you get to the playoffs and those whistles go in pockets, suddenly, you know, if you're overly reliant on that being your source of goals, that goes away. I get my question is to you guys. I'm not trying to take away from Edmonton, because there are players that did have good games for them tonight. But to me, maybe it's just the eye test, but it felt like the Sharks lost this game much more than the Oilers really won it. It was 1-0 for a long period of time, and the Sharks were flubbing things. They were playing out of position, but it didn't necessarily feel like the Oilers were drawing them out of position. I don't want to say like I'm in panic mode necessarily. Although this wasn't a great game, and Ben, to your point, it's great that they kind of stole a game essentially, because these were two home Edmonton games. And I feel like if we play like a little bit more like the first game, great. But what I am a little concerned about is we're seeing the Jekyll and Hyde Sharks. Now, if that's the case, I'm a little more comfortable in some respects with that than I am sort of where we were with the Penguins last year, which is I looked at the Penguins and I was like, that's the better team.
So to me, it depends on what the reaction to this is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So like, if the reaction is, well, if those guys are going to fly around headhunting, then it's Haley time, which is the wrong reaction. If all the reaction is Jumbo forces his way into the lineup in game three and he's not ready, that's the wrong reaction.
Yep. Which, by the way, I'm terrified is going to be the case.
And if the reaction is all systems go on the power play the way it is, that's the wrong reaction. Because you just have, you know, I meant to say this on a podcast last week or the week before, and it just happens that we got to see more of it tonight. You just have to look at the Oilers power play to see a functioning, dangerous power play where guys are in close and folks don't fumble the puck or pass too early or force it back to the point or what have you. Tyler Dello, you know, longtime stats guy, has been looking at the Sharks play power play from this year and last year when it was better. And the Sharks definitely have forgone putting pucks into the dangerous areas to put it back to Burns more this year than they did last year, when we even thought they did it a little too much then, and it was very much, you know, predictable.
Yeah.
And in a large sense, that's why the power play this year is worse than last year's, is that they are forcing it too much back there rather than trying to get pucks into Pavelski in the middle or Couture in the middle or sneak Burns up into that spot where Pavelski likes to fire from. I mean, it feels to me like it's been months since we saw Pavelski uncork one of those shots from the circle.
And I think one of the...
But what the hell are they doing?
Well, we're a team that has, you know, had some crutch strategies. You know, we've got Thornton as our from the boards passer, which, you know, lets you be a bit lazy about your positioning. I know Alex, his favorite hateful subject on our power play is our complete terrible spacing, we're not tight on our triangles, we're not providing the outlet passes or the cross passes. And I think that, you know, is not Thornton's fault. I think it's everyone else's fault in reaction to how good Thornton is on the pass. You don't have to create, you know, tight lanes with good positioning. You don't have to create good supported passing options with good positioning and good movement off the puck. You just get Thornton the puck, let him view the ice, and, you know, he magics it over to somebody sick. And now we've got, you know, and we've got Burns, we've got Pavelski. You mark those two guys, and all of a sudden our bad habits start to show and our laziness starts to show. And
that's the coaches are paid to fix that shit. So what are they doing?
But look at our second unit power play. I mean,
That thing is garbage.
In the first game, our second unit was showing energy, was showing, you know, drive, was trying to make things happen off the puck. And, you know, I think we need to give some of the classic Sharks power play unit guys some looks. I'm not saying sit Pavelski. I'm not saying sit Burns. I'm saying maybe don't put them both on the ice at the same time.
But I totally hear where you're coming from. And DeBoer definitely mixed things up in this game, and it didn't exactly help anything, because in one case he had fucking Paul Martin on the ice during the power play. And he definitely was moving guys around. It's not about the personnel. Earth the DeBoer. The problem is not your personnel at this point. Like, your propensity of throwing it back to the, you know, blue line, to whoever is there, it's not fucking working. So you got to they're going to have to try something else, right?
Wait, and I thought part of that is because sunshine.
You turned him.
part of it is, again, like, it is power play malpractice that Mark Edward Vlasic is on the point and the power play.
Yeah.
A. B. You don't solve that by putting the second slowest defenseman on the team. Okay, I guess, let's see, it goes slowest is Martin. Okay, first slowest guy in place of the second slowest. Right back there either. So, I mean, they've got a lot of work to do, a lot to figure out between now and game three. And I'm happy that the Sharks are coming back with a win, because I didn't think they would.
Yeah. Well, I thought we were going to
split. So bad tonight.
Yeah. I honestly thought we were going to split the first two games. I just thought we were going to split, you know, lose game one, get game two. Your point on speed, though, I think Alex's point on positioning is a lot stronger, because we've seen, you know, we've seen Sharks teams that are way, way slower than this team have a much better power play because they work the cycle, they work the positioning that much better.
Yeah, that's what concerns me is I'm seeing guys chase or I not being on the ice. It's obviously hard to tell whether or not it's a communication issue or what it is. But like a good example is if you look at the triangle, that triangle ought to be a proper evenly shaped triangle because you're trying to do quick cycles with one guy essentially in front of the net so that if you do pass back to the point, that is a quick shot. You're just trying to lure defense out of position. So you get a quick shot off and then collapse into the rebound. The problem with the Sharks power play right now, to me, is that triangle is like an obtuse triangle. And so it's spreading it out, and that requires some form of a cross ice pass. And we saw a lot of that in game two, which was disturbing. There was one pass, I know it connected while a lot of other passes didn't, but it was a Meyer like diagonal all the way across ice and burnt, which is the most ill-advised pass you can make because anyone can step in, pick that off, and you've got, an odd man counterattack on the other side or a breakaway. Well, So to Colin's point, for me, it really is like those players need to be disciplined to play the formation. And if that formation is not going to work for the team for whatever reason, then you need to be looking at other power play formations and not trying to force one in because you have a single capable shooter from the point.
I don't think you could just blame cross ice passes as being the problem in this power play because you've got to get those cross ice passes because you've got to get the goalie moving laterally, right?
So, but the idea of a cycle is that you're not doing the cross ice passes on the cycle and they're running a cycle based power play.
And like, also, if you're not tight on your formation, you have your own players standing in your cross ice shooting or passing lanes like we saw in both games. And, I think we saw a couple of times in game two where the wrong player took the pass and the player with the open lane to the net didn't get it. And so it turned into either a, block shot or a turnover.
Like I said, I haven't seen the sorts of dangerous plays we saw from the power play last year where cross ice to the circles from jumbo to paths. They just don't even seem to be supported under whatever the fuck the Sharks are running right now. And that's a problem because that's the dangerous pass. Instead, what they're trying to do is diagonal passes from the point to a guy on the other side. And that can be dangerous, but they certainly haven't managed to do it with the right timing, with the right lane, or any of that stuff. By the way, this doesn't fix itself just because Jumbo comes back.
No, not at all.
Because I think part of the problem has been, you've got to get the lanes to open for this to work, whatever you're trying to do. And the guys just aren't moving around on the power play at all. And again, that's contrasted by Edmonton's power play, where the guys are constantly moving. They're constantly reforming. And it's not a triangle like the Sharks do. It feels more like an umbrella to me, but you guys know the structures better than I do.
Well, with the way that they're playing, the way that they're spread out, it's a little bit of neither, it seems. Yeah. The other thing I noticed tonight especially was, and you can see the frustration coming from a lot of the people passing the puck, was there seemed to be a lot of, again, it feels like it's a communication thing. There were a lot of really poorly received passes as well. In fact, there was one where Tierney had a pretty open pass. I think it was in the third, and the camera was still on him when he literally looked down and said, "Shit."
Well, what was interesting to me is it felt like Edmonton and San Jose were playing on different ice.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how bad it looked. The Sharks couldn't complete a pass to save their life.
So Ben, let me ask you this. Which Sharks team is the real McCoy here?
I don't know. Unfortunately, because of March, I'd have to say that tonight's Sharks is the real McCoy.
Colin, I want to hear your response to that.
I honestly think I think the Jekyll and Hyde analogy is exactly on point. It's not even which team shows up per game; it's which line shows up per shift. And like we didn't even see our fourth line, that Tierney, Sorensen, Meyer line, who, they weren't generating a whole bunch, but man, were they contributing energy and they just seemed to be everywhere. And you had Sorensen throwing his, you know, 5 foot nothing frame at people.
I don't know. I thought Tierney was invisible tonight, personally.
No, but that's what I'm saying, is in game one.
Oh, gotcha.
Those guys were everywhere, and Tierney was great along the boards. He was freezing play long enough to let people move. He was being strong. You know, he was looking fast for Tierney. And, I mean, and you take game two, and it's just nothing. And, I mean, on the whole point of shooting, I would love to see LeBanc get put into the lineup. I have no idea who should sit in favor of him, but we need to put somebody like him who shoot first mentality, because we need to get that back on the ice. We need to.
I can tell you who I would swap out for him. I'd swap out Meyer.
That feels like the easy choice, but at the same time, I feel, I don't know. I'm still feeling.
I mean, you guys know Haley's coming in, right?
Yeah. It's inevitable. Thornton and Haley. Look, the second the Sharks lost, my initial reaction was, well, this is when they were like, you know, it's up to Thornton when he really feels like he needs to come in. And I'm like, oh, it's going to be the second they lose.
I mean, somebody's got to take the roughing penalty or the unsportsmanlike conduct penalty when they can't get Cash into fight. So that's Haley.
No, but he's going to go and fight Nurse.
See, I don't. I thought. I thought Meyer was fantastic in game one.
Yes, I agree.
He was
fantastic in game one.
And I think there were a lot of guys who were pretty missing in action tonight. And I wouldn't necessarily say Meyer was one of those guys completely missing in action. I know you guys didn't like that pass to Burns. Other people did like that pass to Burns.
Well, yeah, because that pass ended up being completed. My dislike of that pass is not so much. Yeah, you know, if you could. You know how it works. If you complete a pass, it's great. And if you don't, there's an egg on your face. Ultimately, my point with that pass is that is a dangerous play that you didn't really need to take. And if you make it a habit, not as a player necessarily, although certainly as a player as well, but as a team, if you make a habit of doing those cross-ice passes instead of smaller, more controlled passes, or bringing it up, you know, along the wings of neutral zone or whatever you can do, you're putting yourself at risk to have it picked off and there to be a turnover. And there are players specifically chomping at the bit, baiting you to make that pass.
Sure.
They all play the Penguins.
So I'll tell you what, if I'm DeBoer, I actually don't make a single change for game three.
Oh, I don't either.
I challenge the team to play like they did in game one. I give them another shot.
I totally agree with you. I would not make a change for game three.
I would change the power play though.
Yeah. Well, you can change. Well, you can certainly mix up line assignments if you needed to. But I agree. Especially because you had two polar opposite performances here.
And I wonder to some extent. I know you guys don't like the Sharks PK very much, even though it's been somewhat competent, not great.
Better than power play.
But I wonder if the PK, the way it's structured, is part of our power play's problem, right?
Because we're double shifting people.
Well, not just that. I wonder if it's, you know, if you think about it, like who practices against who and what and how. Yeah. If this PK is playing against our power play and the power play looks more or less okay against not a great power play, I wonder if that's, you know, giving the guys not a false sense of security per se, but like they're not really dealing with a good PK, so. Yeah. So they're not getting growing and learning, advancing, you know, what have you.
That makes sense. I would love to see Sorensen on the power play more. He's scrappy. He's quick. He's got great hands. And he just seems hungry. But, like, the line that I don't love is Donskoy, Marlowe, and Ward. I feel like that's the leftovers line.
I think we know why you don't like that.
Yeah, it's Marlowe.
No. So my beef with Marlowe right now is he should be like one of the best 200-foot players on the ice for our team, like in the regular season and last season.
Point out, Colin, before you finish this thought, you have a different beef with Marlowe every week.
No, I'm trying to be fair and I'm trying to be nice now. And like in game one, I think Marlowe just wasn't playing with the urgency. He wasn't. Last year's playoff Marlowe just seemed to be everywhere. And, you know, he seemed to be, you know, pressuring the puck and just trying to get in on the plays and really driving and really pushing. I don't like Marlowe at center. I think it gives him responsibilities that he shouldn't have, and it doesn't let him sort of play the long game to his strengths. I think he's way better when he's on the wing and he gets to play in that lane and not have to worry about being, you know, in front of both nets at all times. I don't think he and Ward are ever going to rediscover that magic they had for like the 10 games that they just seemed to sing together.
Well, that magic required them to be with Couture.
Yeah.
That's part of the problem.
And I mean, maybe that's it. And I honestly feel like Donskoy is having to carry both those guys. And like, how many times did we see Marlow carry through the neutral zone versus Donskoy? I honestly feel like Donskoy is tasked on that line with carrying the neutral zone, and you know, you can't single role somebody like that.
Right. Well, or you know, that's his preference, is to carry the puck, and so that's what he does.
And I mean, on the flip side, Donskoy and Marlow don't seem to gel really well, because Marlow had two times in the first game where he was in brilliant position with momentum, and Donskoy just had to put a, you know, nice off pass to his tape, and Marlow has a lane to the net and maybe a goal, and Donskoy flubs the pass. You know, he pushes too hard, he gets it into Marlow's skates, you know, passes behind him. It just seems like those guys are running on different clocks, and it's not working for me.
Yeah, I mean, we're still at a point, you know, you and I talked about this a lot, Colin, that, you know, this team hasn't found its line combinations. And granted, you know, it's hard to do that when Jumbo's out. So you're shuffling. And if Jumbo comes back, you're obviously going to have to change things again. But there hasn't really been line chemistry this year.
You know what would solve that problem? Dan O'Regan.
Well, but
I don't disagree.
Same question though. Who sits?
Well, that's, so this goes back to like DeBoer, honestly, like his stubborn, you know, his fourth line has to do a particular thing. Yeah. Right. And that particular thing is to be physical and for lack of a better term, grind guys through that. And if they score a goal, it's kind of just happenstance, right? Not exactly by design. So, you know, for O'Regan to come up means that he's going to he'd have to do something completely different that he just doesn't see the fourth line doing. Or, you know, he's going to put O'Regan on the third line, which.
Oh, I don't realistically think O'Regan's coming up. I think they're going to keep him down there for the AHL playoffs.
Yeah.
I was joking, although the one thing I do really, I mean, I've been talking about O'Regan since, you know, he was in college with you guys, but the thing that I really like about his game is that, you know, even though he's small and even though, you know, he might not be putting up a ton of points when he comes up to the NHL, the one thing that I do notice about him is that he spreads the play quite a bit. And it always seems like something happens when he's on the ice, which is something that some, you know, in a game like tonight, the Sharks could use. But again, I want to go back to Ben, your point, because I thought that point was perfect, which was the Sharks probably shouldn't make a drastic change here, at least not yet. The series is tied at 1-1. The Sharks stole a game on the road. They now have two games at home. They had two polar opposite performances. So, you know, if they had two skunks in a row, I'd be like, burn it all down. but in this, even with the injuries, I'd still be like, try something else. But, and you know, in this situation where you had such, I can't think back to a time in Sharks playoff history where they had two just strikingly different performances back to back like that before. Yeah. And it is really hard to tell, like, okay, who is the real, who it, are, were the, because you can even ask us about the March Sharks, you know, like, is that the real Sharks team?
I mean, that's the problem though.
We have struggled all season trying to figure out what is the identity of the team.
We had an entire month though of this fumbly, try to do too much, you know, prone to big mental errors team. And then, you know, just because one game this team woke up and looked more like the team last year doesn't mean that's who they are.
Also,
they're much more likely to be the March team, unfortunately.
Thanks for the downer.
Yeah. Thanks for the sunshine there, buddy.
I mean, I'm hoping this isn't true. I mean,
so just to bring us back to not changing, I sincerely feel like just small line tweaks are necessary.
Okay, sure.
I just mean
don't change like the roster.
Don't bring people off the bench that have been riding the press box quite yet. It's not that point in time where you need to be shuffling like crazy.
Because it's not like, I mean, it's not like a great player who's going to score 5 goals is riding the bench, right? Nope. The guys who could draw in are just not going to give you the advantage you're looking for here. Period.
And just because we keep bringing up Haley, I'll characterize why a core example of where Meyer is far superior to Haley in that he drew the penalty after the play by playing the whistle and then backing off and letting somebody get in his face and walking away from it. You know, Haley.
Oh yeah. He drew that great penalty against Lucic in game one. I mean, that was fantastic.
And I mean,
it's exactly what you need.
You know, he isn't getting into the nonsense. You know, he's being just chirpy and just chippy enough to get under people's skin so that they do dumb stuff. Not that Lucic needs much prompting.
No. I mean, it is worth noting in the AHL, he does have that tendency to be the guy who Lucic is. So he's going to have to play against that instinct of his.
But he's doing it. And, you know, he's doing it as a rookie in playoffs. So,
yeah, so far.
Definitely. Yeah. But, I mean, 2 games is still better than I'd expect of Haley.
Gents, here's the good news. We got plenty more playoffs here. I want to move into the 3 stars.
Let's hope.
We have stars this week.
We have at least 4 more games, Ben. Or 3 more games, Ben. Let's go 3 stars. Colin, who are your 3 stars of this week? Remember, there was a Calgary game that was played.
Let's see. 3rd star. Ew, that's hard. 3rd star is going to be Hansen. Because even in game 2, I don't have negative things to say about him.
I feel like you just like Hansen.
I'm really surprisingly, I do. I typically hate inheriting knuckleheads, but you know he was a good pick. 2nd star is gonna go to Couture. I mean he's walking wounded and you know playing great for having half a face.
Yeah. Can I say I'm a little torn about that, by the way?
Yeah.
I love Couture to death. I really do. And what he's giving to this team is courageous and gutsy and all those things you want your players to be. But holy crap, man, pain exists for a reason.
Yeah.
And he, you know, before the first game, he talked about how, like, he couldn't eat without pain. He can't talk without pain.
Yeah, trouble breathing.
Here he is taking, and here he is taking hits from guys like Zach Cashin, unpenalized bullshit hits.
Oh, actually, no. I have to change up my stars because you've reminded me of something, and I'm gonna try to throw some mojo into our future. So, tied for 2nd star is Kilcher and Hurdle. My 1st star is the player safety board, who are obviously gonna throw some suspensions Edmonton's way for their blatant headshots because that's what they do, and they do it so well.
If it were Rafi Torres, sure.
Yeah, right, yeah. I'm going to go next, Ben, if you don't mind.
Yeah, feel free.
My 3rd star is Dan O'Regan, who not only had his... he's kind of playing the Epicanto. No, but hear me out, Colin. He had his 1st NHL goal this week, and he also got the title AHL rookie, which is a very big deal, especially for the Sharks. Again, we talked about this a lot this season. And last season as well, about how well the Sharks replenish on the fly. Not that he was one of those players because he was drafted, you know, a bit ago. But that's a good, you know, week-long performance, even if it is of a mostly AHL player. My 2nd star is going to go to, I'm bouncing around between Joel Ward and Hurdle. Hurdle because I really liked his game 1 performance overall. Ward because I think that 1st goal was a pretty clutch goal. On his behalf, even if, at least for the Paul Martin goal, that's really more Hurdle than Martin. But those guys are going to kind of tie something for me. And my number 1 for obvious reason is going to be Melker Karlsson for that game winner in the 1st game.
Yeah.
Ben, you're up. Now you can complain about my picks.
I'm not going to complain about your picks. What I was going to say was, you know, Ward is an interesting pick given how challenging of a year he's had, even if he did.
Remember, regular season doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
But anyway, so three stars of the week.
We're talking about the week, Ben. We're talking about the week.
Yeah. Oh, boy, what a week. if only I could just select based on game one.
And yeah, that's literally what I did because he sat out the Calgary game, right?
Yeah, that's true.
He didn't have a great game tonight, so.
No, he did not. Yeah, this is tough. Tim Peel is my third star.
Wow, look at that. The Oilers.
I can go so many different ways because, the way you went with O'Regan, you know, given that how he's performed at the AHL level, I mean, you could give Tori Grosinek just as much love and praise.
Don't forget, the first goal was in there.
Yeah, right. That's still.
Hey, I've been given a star consistently all season for first goals, buddy.
Oh, have you? I hadn't noticed.
Yeah. I'm about as consistent for better or worse than Marlowe. That's right, Colin. I said it.
Did Sorensen get one for his first goal?
I don't think so.
That's because I don't think I podcasted that week with you guys.
No, that might be true.
Convenient.
All right. Anyway, my three stars. I'm going to give my third star to Coach Herr, for just
so enthusiastically too, Ben.
He's our number two center. He's been great this year, or as good as anyone else on this team has been, because not much of this team has been great consistently throughout the year. And
there's that positivity.
So very gutsy, playing the way he feels and giving.
I like that, Ronick.
Everything he's got.
That's really good of you, Ronick.
And taking, it was funny because in game one, one of the penalties that he drew was very much that guy's injured penalty, the Griba elbow. So to speak. And then in game two, he gets fucking launched at by a human missile and nothing, just nothing for that one. So Coach played well in both games, I thought. Maybe one of the few guys, I think, who played well in both games. Second star I'll give to Hurdle because his game one was transcendent. As good as his game two was invisible. First star?
The Ben giveth and the Ben taketh away.
I don't know. Burns was I maybe part of the problem tonight. Maybe the difference between game one and game two. With game one, Burns was everywhere, launching shots from everywhere. I mean, he said something like 19 shot attempts. I think he had 7 shots on goal. So not only was he throwing it at in the general direction of the net, he was putting it on net too.
The Sharks also had a great game. Coaching defense. I don't know if you saw, but in a few rushes on the first game, he was very visibly, pointing out marks and assigning people to, positions.
Yeah, I think I noted that. I think he was trying to do that tonight too. It just didn't matter because he was supposed to be on the power play at the time. and in that sense, he was more or less not a factor tonight. And I don't know if that had something to do with changes that Edmonton made. I have my doubts because again, we're not very high on McClellan, but something was different and he was less effective. But with how good he was, despite not scoring in game one, I guess I'll give him the star because honestly, I don't know really if anybody deserves a star after tonight.
All right, guys, we have. If you don't like hearing us talk about the Sharks Oilers, I have bad news for you because we have 4 games potentially this week. Sharks take on the Oilers again at home this time on Sunday at 7:00.
Yeah. We've got a minimum of 3 games.
A minimum, yes. Right. They play again on Tuesday at 7:00 at home. Then they play Thursday at Edmonton, and then we'll see whether or not they play. Well, Saturday doesn't count for that week, so I lied. There's 3 games. You are correct, Ben. One last thing I want to cover off on before we go that affects the Sharks' future. Are you ready for this?
No, I'm not ready for
couple
this.
A couple of NHL coaching changes.
Announced. Hitchcock!
Hitchcock's back with Dallas. Not only that, but Gallant is now
Vegas as a coach.
Vegas, and also Ben, Uh-oh. Your favorite. Hey, what did the Kings decide to do this week?
Daryl Sutter, everybody. Off to work on his farm.
I'm going to miss his post-game press conferences.
I'm glad you brought that up.
And Lombardi, too, by the way. The architect of both the Sharks and the Kings resurgence.
There is nothing better than a Daryl Sutter press conference, win or lose, in the playoffs.
Correct.
Nothing better.
Correct.
I would wait with bated breath last year, the year before. Well, not the year before, because the Sharks didn't make it to the playoffs. But the year before that, I would wait with bated breath for Popeye to give his perspective on the game, which was usually a tangent at best. And now we're not going to have that anymore because I don't think he's coming back.
Yeah, see, you and I disagree there. I think both he and Lombardi are going to find homes pretty quickly. Even if Sutter claims he's going to retire, I don't believe it.
Sutter's done. But here's the thing. Like, I tried to find the same joy in watching McClellan give his post-game after game one. Obviously, we haven't had a chance to go watch those videos for game two because we came right here to podcast. And he was talking about baseball or something.
Yeah, that's
yeah, Ben. Low batting average. And I'm like, Todd, man.
Ben, without giggling, can you tell me who's now in charge of the Kings?
Rob Blake, right? And Luke Robitaille?
You got it. So, hey, guys, the division has gotten that easier.
it already was.
Yes, true.
I mean, the Canucks fired their coach, but their coach isn't their problem.
Yeah.
Entirely. So what you're telling me, they're going to trade Doughty to the Penguins for like a third round.
Sure.
I'm just going to say those guys could do anything. You don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah, we have no idea. That's exactly right.
That concludes our podcast for this week. Hey, we tried an experiment today. We decided to have a game thread going on Facebook. So if you are a fan of the page or a friend of ours, that might be something we do again. So pay attention.
I don't know. We lost after this one.
And we are a little superstitious, but I got to admit, it was fun letting people see our discussions because sometimes I feel like our game day discussions are actually better than our podcasts. But don't tell anyone I said that. Oh, I just said it.
You dummy.
Well, guys, say goodbye.
No.
No. This is not the time of the season for goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
This is the time to win.
Bye-bye.
Go, Sharks.
Go, Sharks.
Go, Sharks.
Please, Sharks, please. Fix the power play.